This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark, with promises to end austerity, Syriza was swept to power in Greece. But with the money running out fast, can the new Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, convince the rest of Europe to negotiate? And we ask, are there lessons for other European progressive parties, including Labour? Also this week, instant fact-checking, real-time rebuttal and polls of polls. What role will data play in the general election campaign? Joining me for all of that, we've got The Guardian's data editor, Alberto Nardelli, and down the line from Berlin, the director of the redefined think tank, Sonny Kapoor. A warm welcome to you both. Now, in 2009, Syriza were grateful for a mere 5% of the vote and 13 seats. This week, Alexis Tsipras is the country's youngest prime minister, and his party holds nearly half of the seats in parliament. His aims are, to put it mildly, ambitious. He wants to abandon austerity, fight off Greece's creditors, and heal his country's wounded pride. Helena Smith is in Athens for The Guardian. The European Parliament president's in town, the banks are taking a hammering, there's jitters around the stock markets. We had a lot of hope on the streets of Athens just a few days ago. Is it already giving way to fear?
Well, I think within certain circles, financial circles, and those who are radically opposed to Syriza, yes. But I think it's too early to say, to put labels like fear on a situation on the ground. A lot of Greeks are really quite hopeful with this sea change in politics that has taken place in the last week, and recognise that they need time before they cast opinions or have any opinion really about the situation on the ground. What we have seen is a week very rich in symbolic gestures, and that has pleased Greeks for sure. Tsipras certainly hasn't wasted any time in conveying his message that this is a radically different government. It's a government of the left. His first act as prime minister was to visit a World War II memorial erected in honour of 200 Greek leftists who were executed at dawn on May 1st, 1944 by Nazi SS officers here in Athens. And then, of course, with the government's first day in office, the hated barricades around the parliament building erected by the previous administration to keep angry Greeks enraged over austerity measures away from the house, amid signs that the parliament was going to be stormed in a couple of demonstrations. They have been brought down, dismantled as well. And then, of course, all manner of austerity measure that has been imposed at the behest of international creditors on Greeks over the last 5 years have also been rolled back with really quite alarming speed. In his first day in office on Wednesday, 10 bills were basically announced, everything from reinstating the minimum wage to granting the children of migrants born and bred in Greece Greek citizenship. So they're moving fast, and the symbolism is not lost on those who are watching it here in Greece.
So some very dramatic kind of public politics. But what about in the back room? Because it's often said when you get a new politics and then when deals need to be done, it soon gives rise to an old politics. And of course, Tsipras's big task is to try and do a big deal with Germany. Do you think he's going to, from what you're seeing this week, do you think he's going to be someone who in the end is capable of ticking and tacking and compromising? Or do you think he's going to go into this with all guns blazing?
It would seem that he's going to go into this with all guns blazing, given the appointees in his newly formed government, appointing Yanis Varoufakis, the radical Greek-Australian economist, to the post of finance minister, has certainly sent a message. Varoufakis is a maverick. He's highly unpredictable. As such, people see him as a very dangerous force, a loose cannon. Despite his moderating his speech in the last week and insisting that Greece does not want to have a clash with creditors or the European Union, it wants to simply renegotiate its friendship with the European Union. But that really remains to be seen. A lot of political analysts here in Athens truly believe that this is a very confrontational government, that confrontational politics loom ahead, that the possibility of fresh elections being called in the next 3 months is really quite real, and that that could be the strategy that is being plotted right now in Athens.
Helena Smith there in Athens. Now, Sonny Kapoor, Tsipras has said he wants an end to austerity and to avoid a clash with the creditor countries as well. You're in Berlin, fittingly enough. Can he really do both those things at once, avoid the clash but also end austerity?
I think that there's a lot of posturing from both sides, and hence at least the appearance of a clash in the run-up to what is likely to be a reasonably sensible compromise that doesn't go as far enough as Tsipras promised or as Greece needs, but at the same time doesn't inflict an immediate burden on German and French taxpayers, because that would be politically toxic. So I think, yes, the bluster as well as the aggressive tone is part of the process, as expected, that will eventually lead to a compromise.
But do you worry, Sonny, that people get locked in? You know, I mean, Tsipras has got obviously a very excited and agitated constituency that might start to cry in the traditional left-wing way, betrayal if he compromises after all the tough talk. And Merkel's got plenty of people snapping at her heels for already having bailed out Greece too often, hasn't she? Couldn't people become locked in rather than coming together?
Well, that is absolutely correct, but some data here is interesting, that austerity in the strictest sense was already sort of coming to an end in Greece. The worst of Greek austerity is already behind it. With the ECB intervention last week, wherein it's going to buy a significant number of government bonds, interest rates have fallen further, and that will also relieve some more fiscal space in Greece. That combined with what is likely a reduction in interest rates on Greek loans, as well as perhaps a deferral of some of the payments that are due, means that people on the streets can actually start seeing a reversal of austerity as much as 2-3% of GDP, which after years of such shoddy cuts, very, very serious cuts, that have impacted healthcare, increased in higher suicides, etc., will actually be visible. So I think it is possible, once you get beyond the headlines, for people within Greece to see the benefits of Tsipras' stance, as well as for Greece's partners, if they are sensible and reasonable, to allow him to be able to do that. So we don't necessarily end up with an unsustainable confrontational situation. This could also go well.
Oh, well, that's an encouraging thought. I mean, how do you see it, Alberto? Obviously, Tsipras has got this great democratic mandate, but so does Angela Merkel.
I think there are two big strands here. So I think on the one hand, there's the economic argument. And one of the challenges that Greek debt has actually been restructured twice already. The maturity, for example, on loans to Greece is about 16 and a half years in average, about double that of Germany and Italy. And so if you're a Greek citizen and you see that these types of deals have been done before, but the results haven't actually benefited the citizens of Greece, I'm not sure how a restructuring of the debt using the methods which have already been tried twice will work. And more importantly, I'm not sure other countries in Europe will be happy to see Greek repayments constantly postponed while their repayments are coming up. And then on the other hand, I think there's the political question. You have various countries in Europe, above all Portugal and Spain, both due elections this year, where you have a very strong left anti-austerity movements. And if you're Germany and other European countries, you're in this very difficult situation where you know that if Syriza governs effectively and successfully, people within Spain and Portugal will be more inclined to support such parties because they see it doesn't mean the end of the world. On the other hand, you think if Syriza fails and Greece becomes, let's call it an example, people will be less inclined to vote for these parties because Greece's economy is relatively small compared to the Eurozone. But when you start looking at a country like Spain, one of the largest economies in Europe, it's a very different ballgame.
Now that, Sonny, is a fascinating point, isn't it? Because we always hear an awful lot about the dangers of economic or financial contagion. And you can see that if, heaven forbid, Greece slid out of the Eurozone, then the speculation would turn to who's next in the tried and tested market panics way. But Alberto there's suggesting something different, a kind of political contagion, that if Merkel lets Cyprus succeed, then people on in Ireland or in Portugal or in Spain are going to say, well, we want some of that too.
That's absolutely correct. And I believe that we have seen political contagion already. That having been said, one's got to remember that despite its poor track record, the EU has some sensible heads involved in the decision making, and the role of the IMF is particularly encouraging. And if the stark choice is between a Grexit, which leads to financial and economic contagion, as well as, you know, the destruction of the integrity of the Eurozone on the one hand, and a more likely scenario where Podemos and other populist leftist parties could win, I think that the mandarins of the Eurozone and Angela Merkel would decide to go for the second option. And I think that this might be actually the fork in the road we are at. So I believe that there are enough sensible heads that things will not come to a pass where Greece will be sacrificed so that Podemos is not allowed to win in Spain.
And if that does happen, if you get a left turn in Spain, in Portugal, and the Greek thing seems to be working to the extent that, you know, that Greece is back up off the bottom, does that then change the whole mood music around the debate on austerity elsewhere in France, in Germany itself, perhaps, and maybe even here in Britain, where there's an election campaign just getting underway in which austerity is the big issue?
Well, 3 points there. One is, one definitely hopes so, because austerity has inflicted huge economic, financial and social damage. Second, as I mentioned in the case of Greece, there are clear signs, if you look at the numbers, that the worst of austerity, not just for Greece, but the whole of the Eurozone and also for the UK, is behind us. The third point, I think, which is important, is that it would be a plus for the whole of the Eurozone if the southern countries, if the crisis countries get together, if the somewhat left of center parties get together and actually force Germany's hand to have a better deal that is politically and economically sensible for the Eurozone, where in exchange of a promise of longer term structural reforms, movement towards services liberalization and fiscal union, as well as labor market reform, you get a relaxation of austerity. And particularly with the ECB having acted, the chances of all of that happening are good. And my last point is that it's incorrect to think of these parties as leftist populist only, because these parties and their popularity and their sudden rise is definitely the result of the failure of main political parties, both in Greece and in Spain, to have delivered good governance. Those are clientelist parties, corruption is in the air, and this is as much a vote against corruption as it is against austerity.
Alberto, you keep an eye, I know, on politics across Europe. There are other forms of populism in Northern Europe that are more concerned. I mean, obviously we know about UKIP here, but within the Euro, there's the true Finns, for example, aren't there? I mean, if what Sonny's talking about there, and you get the increasingly assertive and confident parties who are anti-corruption, anti the old corruption, but also anti-austerity in the south of Europe, pushing back, do you think that Northern Europe will go along with that? Or do you think, in fact, what will happen is that the populist right will be emboldened there instead of the populist left in the south?
I think if we take a step back, one of the big challenges is that if you look at, so if we look at just, say, economic targets, Spain had very good retail figures, for example, this morning. Italy more or less hits its deficit targets. But then if you start digging deeper, you see, for example, in a country like Spain, at its peak, there are a few hundred people who get evicted every single day. And you have families who are trying to live on 400 euros a month. Italy has record high unemployment, and it keeps rising despite all the reforms. And even in Northern Europe, you take, for example, if you look at pay within the UK, it's been flat for quite some time now. And so you have parts of society across Europe, not just in the south of Europe, who feel pressure. They feel that they today they're less off than they were a few years ago. In the south of Europe, you have desperation fundamentally. So like people who are desperate. So if you talk about financial reform for someone who can't go to the supermarket and buy food for their family, that's a very weak argument to make. In Northern Europe, lots of that has come out in terms of finding a scapegoat, which very, very often is found within immigration.
Yeah.
And 4 years ago, the UK was the only country in Europe, so where the yearly Eurobarometer, which the EU carries out every year, only people in Britain said immigration was the biggest issue of concern for the country.
Yeah.
If you look at the most recent figures, immigration concerns for immigration have gone up in most Scandinavian countries. It's gone up in Germany. So people, lots of parts of society, even within Northern European countries, are blaming immigration for the fact that they are less well off, are earning less money, sometimes are unemployed, or in many Northern European countries are underemployed. So you have all of these pressures, and I absolutely agree with Sonny in terms of mainstream parties in many, many countries have really not tried to tackle these issues and have allowed the far right or the far left to really own the debate and exploit.
It's interesting, though, with Cyprus, remarkable difference with what you're talking about in Northern Europe there, because one of the first things he did was is trying to make it easier for people who've arrived in Greece and been brought up in Greece to become nationals. So there's it is a different form, isn't it? Definitely this leftish, more inclusive populism in Southern Europe.
And I think even in terms of, if you look, for example, at the speech which Chancellor Merkel gave in Germany at the end of the year and how much she dedicated to immigration and basically saying Germany is a country of immigrants and needs immigrants and trying to steer the debate in a different direction. But very few leaders in Europe try to have a grown-up debate about immigration. And that fuels uncertainty, fuels fears and a debate, which is very emotional.
And now, immigration is just one of the subjects at the moment where the whole rhythm of the discussion is dictated by numbers. In Britain, we've got this net immigration target. But all across Europe and all across politics and economics, data and numbers are becoming more and more central to the discourse. And Sonny, if we think about Greece itself and how it got into the Eurozone in the first place, there were a lot of numbers flying around, but it turned out that they weren't very good, didn't it?
That is absolutely true. And Eurostat made significant changes to how data is measured and reduced the scope for interpretation and cheating. But just to clarify,
when did it do that?
As part of the Euro crisis reforms in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
But it came after the recognition of Greece having lied on its numbers. But the fact of the matter is that this was known to several policymakers, to several other countries, and it was a political decision to let Greece into the Eurozone. It was not an economic decision.
And do you think, obviously, Sonny, you're someone who keeps a keen eye on lots and lots of different sorts of numbers. When you see today in the news, we've got an argument about league tables and whether you can trust them. When you've got an argument about the welfare cap that David Cameron's pushing and claims that it will get lots more people into work. But he's had a letter from the National Statistics Chief, Andrew Dilnot, saying, oh, you've been exaggerating a little bit about that. Do you think in the end this kind of hankering for more facts and more data is going to be a good thing for democracy? Or do you think that exactly with Greece, in the end, the politics will overpower and people will be left with a sense of lies, damned lies and statistics?
I think going back to that quote about statistics, what it reveals is interesting, what it conceals is vital, is an appropriate way of thinking about it. There will always be different ways of interpreting the same numbers, of presenting them, and our politicians are getting more and more creative. And I think that the rise, particularly in Europe, of services that do fact checks, it's now big in the United States too, is encouraging. That combined with politically neutral statistics offices, which are allowed to actually make public statements calling out politicians, which deliberately misinterpret and misrepresent numbers, is the sensible way to go forward. Because I think it's less a question of whether this is desirable or not, but just a question of acknowledging that this is happening. This is a trend that will grow. And having a combination of politically independent statisticians who are able to call out nonsense, together with the rise of civil society of fact checkers. But it is also important to have responsible citizenry who don't just hear what they want to hear, as is happening in the case of United States with the audience of Fox News. So even where fact check services actually exist, people don't really pay attention. I think it's the onus is on mainstream media such as The Guardian to actually try and make sure that people are not allowed to get away with this, that nonsense is actually called out.
What do you think, Alberto? I mean, obviously, that's what you're doing with the data site. You're trying to get the facts straight.
I think, first of all, it's important to make a distinction between things which are completely incorrect, like made-up numbers, for example. I think that's one challenge, and I think having fact checkers and also having a conversation which is much more open now. It's very often that you have a debate, say, for example, on a platform like Twitter, and you will instantly have a debate with many individuals who are experts in so many different fields, and you have that type of fact checking too. I think a much bigger challenge is when the same types of numbers can be interpreted in different ways, and both sides of the argument are kind of right depending on how you interpret those figures, and you need a lot more in-depth and complexity and a much longer argument to go through the numbers. And oftentimes that type of argument doesn't happen in public, or most definitely it doesn't influence public opinion. Finally, I think it's a very important distinction, which data alone will not change, will not always change public opinion. Immigration is a very good example of that. You need to have a data-driven approach, but you also need to have the emotional argument. There's a great stat, I think the immigrant population in the UK is about 13%. Most people in Britain think it's about 2.5 times that figure. Mm. So the perception that people have of issues will then influence what they think about issues. And official statistics on immigration are published all the time, but they need to be coupled with emotional arguments too.
And finally, Sonny, do you think, I mean, just take something like unemployment, where you've got, you know, that you've got the dole queue as measured by the number of people who claim their benefits. And then you've got various survey-based approaches where you knock on the door and ask people if they're unemployed at the moment, and these are going to give you different answers. Sometimes they show the same trend, occasionally they'll show a different trend, but it is asking too much of any politician not just to pick and choose where there are these different numbers, the one that serves their interest, isn't it, where you've got these different sources.
Oh, of course. And so I think we need to be realistic. Politicians will continue to willfully misinterpret, to selectively pick up the data that is useful to whatever it is that they're trying to say. And I think at the end of the day, as long as there are enough checks and balances, as long as they're embarrassed when they say nonsensical stuff or misinterpret stuff too much, then it will lead to a better quality of public debate. But I think what Alberto said about the public opinion not being driven by data is hugely important, particularly on issues such as immigration. And despite whatever information it is that you put out, and no matter how accessible you make it, if you look at surveys, the American public, the British public, the European public remains amazingly misinformed on things like how much money goes to development, on how many immigrants are there, what the level of unemployment is, and so on and so forth. So I think there needs to be more of an effort for public education, perhaps going down to school curricula level, to make sure that the kind of stuff that people most misinterpret and misunderstand is the kind of stuff that they are told facts about from an early age. And the media needs to play an important part in that. It's the only way we're going to get a better informed electorate, information-driven debates and policy.
Now, there are lots of numbers in politics, but there is one type of number that is going to be looked at much more closely than any others. And yesterday, The Guardian launched a new poll of polls tracker, coupled with a rather ingenious new projection of what the polls would say about the House of Commons. And Alberto is the brains behind it. And Alberto, first of all, what is the what's the outcome looking like at the moment?
So I think an important premise is we're not trying to predict what will happen on election day. We're trying to analyse what the polls are saying now, because polls imply a snapshot of what people are saying now.
Yeah.
And what we've done is try and look at the type of polling data that we have available from a constituency level, figures in Scotland, in Wales, and then nationwide figures. And by looking at all these various numbers, the easy bit is that we're heading towards a hung parliament. What's unclear is which between the two main parties, Labour and the Conservatives, will win the most seats. Right now, they are virtually tied. And then the two most important trends are that the Scottish National Party are going to play an instrumental role in whoever forms the next government, and then how voters who are currently saying that they will vote for the Greens on the one hand or UKIP on the other, how their opinion eventually evolves as we near election day, will also play a critical role in terms of the splits on both the left and the right.
Most people who are eccentric enough to listen to Politics Weekly probably already know that the opinion polls are pretty much tied at the moment, 31-32% for each of the main parties. But so in House of Commons seats, there's 650 in total. If it were today, what does your model say?
So the figures that we released yesterday have both the Tories and Labour on 273, the SNP on 40.
Absolute dead heat then.
Yeah. The SNP on 49, the Lib Dems losing about half their seats. UKIP would have about 5 seats, and the Greens the one that they currently already hold.
So, I mean, in that scenario, if it held, it would be not the Liberal Democrats, but the SNP that would be the kingmaker, which would be a recipe for trouble, perhaps.
If those numbers were to take place on election day, then absolutely. I think any type of alliance, any type of conversation will begin with Labour and the SNP.
Can you see with this model how sensitive this sort of outcome is? You know, if for example, the Conservatives can pull back a point or two in the time-honoured fashion of governments in the run-up to elections, or if the SNP slip back a bit, What fronts in this multi-fronted war should we be watching particularly closely to see a big impact on seats?
So first of all, I think Scotland will be the key battleground for the election. And the thing to keep in mind there is Labour has very big margins within Scotland. The majority of the seats that Labour holds, they have a margin of more than 20 points. So we will need to have a very big swing, which is what the polls are showing now for the SNP. To win 45 or so.
So if the SNP bubble bursts between now and May, then Labour looks like it's probably going to be the biggest party.
Because that's 20. That's a block of 25, 30 seats.
Yeah.
Staying with Labour or moving away from Labour.
So that's a lot in a close fight.
That's the most important battleground. The second big thing to look at, there are lots of seats where UKIP have eaten away at the Conservatives. And good examples of these are St Ives and Cornwall North in the southwest, where the Lib Dems are defending themselves from the Conservatives, but you have UKIP who are polling above average in these seats. If a very small number of those voters goes back to the Conservatives can take those seats from the Liberal Democrats. There are lots of seats where Labour are poised to win back from the Conservatives. But again, lots of that isn't always driven by Labour doing well. It's primarily driven by the fact that UKIP has taken support from the Conservatives. If between now and Election Day you have a small number of 2010 Conservative voters who now say they will vote for UKIP going back to David Cameron's party, you have tens of seats going to the Conservatives. So those are really, from a bigger picture point of view, the two big things to look at. I would add a third point, which is this time last election, about one in two people said that they were going to certainly vote in the election. That figure is now closer to 60%.
So you think turnout might go up?
Well, that's what people are saying. And especially in Scotland, that's very important. Because one key fact, if we think back at the independence referendum, turnout was exceptional. It was around 86%. But if you looked at the polls, you had 95% people saying they were certain to vote. Yeah. And they didn't turn out. If that happens again at the elections, we have a very high number of people saying we are certain to vote. If that happens again, especially in Scotland, then that will have an impact primarily on the SNP.
OK, Alberto, that's a terrific tour around the battleground. So my thanks to you, Alberto, as well as to Sonny, and then to Helena, who we heard from earlier in Athens. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.